I will now call the second case set for oral argument today. It's case number A22-1805, Gladys Barkey Asayadu versus Michael Kwabena Asayadu. And I apologize if I've mispronounced the last name, and I'd be happy to be corrected at the time of argument. As you know, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 15 minutes of rebuttal argument. Counsel for appellant, you may approach, and please identify yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument. I should have noted at the beginning that we have multiple lecterns here, and the middle one is the one we have customarily used for years. The other two were set up during the COVID era. You may take your pick. Only the middle one has the green, yellow, red light system. And only the middle one is adjustable. There's a button that kind of at the front edge of the surface there's a motorized device that will move it up and down if you wish. So,
thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Max Keller, M-A-X-K-E-L-L-E-R. I'm here representing the appellant, Michael Asayadu. We're addicted to these red and green lights, so of course I'm here at the magic podium. I was thinking about how to approach this. So one way we might approach this, Your Honors, is to start out with the idea that the OFP, of course, is a creature of statute. So what meets the definition of domestic abuse is defined by the statute. I think that's important to our arguments here. So in 518B.01, subdivision 2A1, says one type of domestic abuse is physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. I think it's pretty clear that the trial court is not finding an OFP based on those things, because the trial court was specifically saying that basically there was no intentional assault, for example, in finding of fact 18, says that petitioner, which is the appellant here, asserts he did not intentionally push either Janelle or petitioner, which is the respondent here, and did not intend to cause either one to fall to the floor. And then the trial court goes on to say respondent, which is appellant here, was at least heedless and reckless, and caused Janelle and petitioner, which is respondent here, to fall to the floor. And then they say, the trial court says, to be in fear of bodily harm. So, of course, the next part of the definition says, number two says, the infliction of fear or imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. And then number three does not apply to this case, talking about terroristic threats and other crimes. So I think it's clear, and the respondent here is not arguing this in their brief, but I think it's clear that what we're talking about here is the infliction of fear, not actual physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. And this is where our hearsay argument is key. The respondent argues that, well, the appellant went up and he testified and he said, well, the appellant went up and testified and said, well, he went up and he brushed past these other people in the household, and they fell down, and so, okay, now he admitted to an assault, and so now that's it. Well, that's not what the trial court found the OFP based on. So here we have a situation where, interestingly, the trial court never actually made any explicitly labeled conclusions of law. Of course, that's not fatal to its order, but it might have been more precise for appellate review. So what we have is only findings of fact and then basically numerous paragraphs of an order. And so, of course, there are some conclusions of law implicitly woven into the findings of fact. And the trial court is saying it never explicitly examined the differences between number one and number two in the definitions, as I just did. But in its findings, the trial court says appellant asserts he did not intentionally push either Janelle or petitioner, which is respondent here. Now, that's interesting because the the trial court has to actually make some credibility determination. So at first, in its findings, it seems to be saying that it's kind of reticent to do that. But ultimately, it seems to find that the appellant here was credible when he said he did not intentionally cause them to fall down. Of course, the trial court says, well, the appellant here was at least heedless or reckless, and his actions caused Janelle and petitioner respondent here to fall to the floor and to be in fear of bodily harm. So now the trial court just found fear. That satisfies number two. Now the problem is, how in the world would the trial court find that they are in fear? Well, it's very clear in the order here on page 6, where it says, the petition for an order for protection as to petitioner Gladys Acidu is denied. So the trial court is not finding that the mother, Gladys, or petitioner respondent here was in fear or that she was intentionally assaulted. So the trial court only issued an order with respect to the children. So how in the world would the trial court be able to find that the children are in fear of bodily harm? It's only through the testimony of the social workers. And that, of course, is hearsay. And
couldn't the court have made that finding based on the testimony of mom? Is that what you do?
I don't think so, Judge Gatiss. Thank you for that question. As far as I understand, she never said that they were in fear. If she did say that they were in fear, then to me, she's just giving her interpretation. She can give whatever interpretation she wants, but that's not a basis for granting an OFP. It is offered for the truth of the matter asserted. The trial court did not deny that. It is hearsay. Hearsay, of course, is an out-of-court statement offered for the truth of the matter asserted.
What about the inference? Could the district court have been within its discretion in inferring from the testimony of both Ms. Acidu and Mr. Acidu that the children, you know, based on the encounter described reasonably were in fear?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. I appreciate that question because this is all the heart of the matter, basically. The respondent here argues that it's not offered for truth, but I think it absolutely is. And so the question is did anyone say they were in fear? Did the people who were supposedly in fear say that? Well, we know for sure the answer to that is no. And that's why, in order to uphold this order, well, the court would have to strain in order to do that and to believe that there's some type of inference. No, I don't think that's correct, because I could come in here and I could say, well, Mr. Acidu was afraid that the Court of Appeals would rule against him. Okay, well, that's my guess. That's my assumption, or that's my interpretation. How do I know that? I don't know that. If you're sitting as a trial court, how would you conclude that he's afraid the court's going to rule against him? You would need him to come in here and testify under oath. So the equivalent of that in this case is the children should have testified. This is a bizarre OFP. It really is. Anyone that has been to an OFP hearing, and I've represented petitioners and respondents, you don't see the assistant county attorney testifying. That's just weird. I've never seen that, not testifying, but presenting the testimony of these witnesses. Why did the assistant county attorney have to come and present the testimony of the social workers? They don't need to. What do the social workers need to testify about? Whatever the social workers have to say, it's completely either irrelevant or it's all hearsay. What are they going to say that's relevant to this proceeding? The only thing they could say that's relevant is that the children told them X. What would the children tell them? Oh, they could say, oh, we're in fear, or this happened or that happened. Well, that's all hearsay, and it's all offered for truth. If mom says it, it's the same thing. If she said, well, I think the kids are afraid, or the kids told me they're afraid, it's all hearsay. It's not up to those people to give their interpretation. We're not talking about 3-year-old children or 6-year-old children, as I pointed out in the brief. These children were 16 and 13, I believe, at the time of the hearing. So there's absolutely no reason that they would somehow be incompetent or unable to testify. And I guess both sides have been through a few different counsel in this case, so I believe the counsel that are here for respondent were not the ones from the trial court, and neither was I, but the respondent's counsel said, as we noted in our brief on page 14, they said the children were unavailable. Well, I don't know what they meant by that, but we do actually have rules of evidence, and they certainly weren't unavailable according to evidence. And even
Mr.
if they
Keller, what about the argument that's being made, availability issue that you pointed out? What about the argument that respondent is now making that any out-of-court statements by these children were exempted from the hearsay rule as statements concerning their state of mind?
Well, as I understand it, Your Honor, thank you for that question. What the respondent is now arguing, which is not what they argued in the trial court and not what the trial court stated at the hearing or in its order, is that the statements were not offered for truth. They were offered to show state of mind. Now, that's an interesting argument. I think you have to think about it kind of hard. So my analogy to try to understand this would be to say, in a criminal case, an officer could testify that he believed such and such for the purposes of probable cause. Now, that's not offered for truth then. It's offered to show probable cause. The officer might be wrong. It might not be true, but it's just what he or she believed at that time. Now, we're not dealing with that type of a situation here. We're dealing with the question of, were they actually in fear? It's not whether someone else believed that they were in fear. It is offered for truth, because if they weren't in fear, or if they were in fear, you have to believe that that's true. Otherwise, I could just say, I want an OFP against Jane Smith. I come in here to the trial court, and I could say, I'm in fear. And someone says, why? I say, well, I don't really have any reasons. I just felt like having an OFP today because I don't have anything else to do. I was bored. And so then they're going to say, well, we don't really believe you that you're in fear, because you have no reason to fear her. You haven't given us any evidence or any explanation. So it is offered for truth. It's not just offered for a state of mind. The state of mind in this case actually has to be true. There are some cases where the state of mind maybe doesn't have to be true, but this is not one of them. the only way we know that they were supposedly in fear is from the testimony of the social workers. That's hearsay, and it was offered for truth, and that's plain and simple. And the trial court never asserted that it was not offered for truth, and neither did the petitioner or the respondent here in the trial court. Now they have a different argument. In findings of fact 23, the trial court said the children, quote, the children, dot, 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 they still have a reasonable fear of domestic abuse from respondent. Now, how in the world would the trial court figure that out? Again, we're talking about fear here, not an actual assault. And the claim is clearly based on the hearsay testimony of the social workers. you have to believe that they were really in fear. You have to believe that they're telling the truth. Now, I have a couple of minutes left here, so I wanted to, well, I guess I'll say this is, it's clearly prejudicial. There's no question about that, because this is the heart of the matter, and there's absolutely no question that the hearsay rules apply to an OFP, and Chief Judge Cleary and the rest of the court found that in your opinion in Olson versus Olson that we cited on In our brief on page 12 at 892 Northwest 2nd, 837. The second part of that is, well, whether it was prejudicial or not, this is a civil case and not a criminal case. So we have to show that the error was prejudicial. It clearly was, because if there is no ability to find fear, the OFP cannot be issued. Now, with my one minute remaining, I wanted to talk about the testimony of social workers per se. So the respondent here argues that, well, Mr. Asidu was not the client of the social workers. And that may be correct, but then arguably the children were the clients of the social workers. And the privilege, of course, the privilege statute says the clients would have to waive the statute. The kids may be too young.
Do you have any case law to support that the father can claim a privilege that was owned by the children on appeal? Like that the appropriate way to challenge the privilege, that only the children would have the right on appeal to challenge the privilege question. Do you have any cases where a privilege has been claimed and a third party is bringing that privilege claim to this court, arguing evidence shouldn't have gotten in because someone else owned the privilege?
Well, thank you for that question, Your Honor. I'm not sure if I understand the question. Are you saying, is there any case law that a third party could assert the privilege?
Yes.
I don't have that case law, but I guess I would say that's not what we're asserting. The children are not a third party. The children are a party, not a third party, and they didn't waive it. And they would have to either waive it, or because they're minors, then their parents would have to waive it, and that did not happen. So I see my time has expired, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may approach. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Opal Richards, and I'm appearing as co-counsel on behalf of respondent Gladys Asidu. We ask this court to affirm the district court's issuance on October 25th of 2022 of an order for protection after hearing, which found that appellant's actions towards the party's children constituted domestic abuse and caused the children bodily injury and caused them to be reasonably in fear of imminent physical harm and bodily injury. This court's decision will determine whether social workers will be able to continue testifying in court proceedings on behalf of children who have suffered domestic abuse or maltreatment over the objection of an abuser's claim of privilege that would seek to prevent the social worker's indispensable testimony.
So, just to interrupt you there, are you suggesting that the district court's decision to issue the OFP in this case absolutely relied on the testimony of the social workers?
It incorporated. I don't think that was the sole purpose or the sole basis, and that would go to question three, but I think that the court made clear that it relied on all the testimony, which included appellant's direct testimony as well as respondent's testimony.
So if we agree with the arguments that are being made by appellant in this case, that the social worker's testimony was erroneously admitted, would we necessarily be required to reverse the issuance of the OFP?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. We feel that even if this court ignores the testimony of both social workers, that the record is still replete with evidence of domestic abuse, appellant's domestic abuse of the children, as provided with respondent's testimony as well as appellant's own testimony. And that is my first question. The court went to it. Even without the challenged social worker's testimony, does the evidentiary record support a finding of domestic abuse and justify the district court's grant of the OFP on behalf of the children? The answer, again, is yes. Appellate review of the district court findings. The appellate court views the record in light most favorable to the findings and will reverse a finding of fact only if the appellate court is left with the definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made. That was Brand X. Rel. Minor Child, 721 Northwest 2nd of 924 at 927. The district court found that appellant had inflicted fear of imminent physical harm and bodily injury on the party's minor children, and that is reflected in the order for protection after hearing, page 5, paragraph 18. The court determined that appellant's actions constituted domestic abuse within the meaning of 518B.01 subdivision 2A. In relying on the testimony other than the social worker's testimony, the hearing transcript, page 14, lines 7 through 10, respondent's credible testimony confirms the domestic abuse. I quote, "I went out of the family room to see what was happening, and I saw Michael, the appellant, running after Michelle, and I also saw that he pushed the older child down." Again, at page 20, lines 1 through 4, "My middle daughter also told him, appellant, that what he was doing was not right. So he got angry and pushed the middle daughter out of a chair." Page 24, lines 11 through 21, "Sometimes when he's teaching them and they're not grasping the concept, he would spank them. And sometimes he gets so violent. One instance when she, Janelle, saw that he was going to hit her, to dodge that hit, she turned her head and actually got hit on the other side of her mouth." As far as appellant's own testimony,
I'll just note, with regard to the last statement that you just made, the district court actually found in finding number 20 that there was a photograph showing the child's swollen lip, but the court specifically found that the record as to how it happened is unclear. So would it be appropriate for us to consider that finding in determining whether the district court abused its discretion in concluding that the children reasonably feared bodily harm?
I don't think, even if the court ignores the photograph, which the district court said was unclear, but respondent's testimony was very clear as to what happened. When appellant was asked, "Do you think that the children are afraid of you?" he said no. And although his testimony minimized his behavior, the district court still concluded that his actions constituted domestic abuse. Hearing transcript, page 72, lines 10 through 15, "I told her, Janelle, to move, and she wouldn't move. So I went through her left side, and my left shoulder brushed her, and she fell." Your Honors, it is not credible that you merely brush someone and they fall, especially when it happens repeatedly. Hearing transcript at page 75, lines 5 through 7, I quote, "I made my way past her," respondent's left side, "and then I saw that she'd fallen to the ground. How remarkable. He merely brushed her, and she also fell." Hearing transcript at page 77, lines 7 through 8, "Then I saw that she," one of the children, "had a bruise on her hand, on her elbow." And then lines 15 through 16, "I was trying to give aid to my daughter who had gotten injured." Those are the words that confirm beyond the shadow of a doubt that he actually injured the children. Therefore, his own testimony refutes his claims that he did not injure them or act in a manner that would cause them to be afraid. The district court noted that, and I quote on page 5, paragraph 18, "the parties' reports of what happened do not differ greatly. Therefore, the court relied in great part on the parties' testimony. Respondent's version is a bit closer to what the children described to Ms. Quirindongo." Then it goes on further to say, "based on all testimony and the exhibits offered, this observation confirms that the district court considered all the testimony." The district court on page 6 at paragraph 23 said, it further noted, I quote, "although circumstances have changed and steps have been taken that protect the children, they still have a reasonable fear of domestic abuse from respondent." Question 2, even if the district court erred in admitting the social worker's testimony about appellant's domestic abuse, was that error harmless? Again, the answer is a conclusive yes. In light of appellant's own testimony, as well as the credible testimony of respondent during the evidentiary hearing, appellant fails to identify any prejudice that is caused by admitting the social worker's testimony. and State versus Blassus, 455 Northwest 2nd, 535 at page 540, the court opined that, and I quote, prejudicial evidence will not warrant reversal if the error was harmless. Whether the error was harmless depends on whether there is any reasonable doubt the result would have been different if the evidence had not been admitted, end of quote. In other words, if the fact finder could have reached its decision based on other evidence presented, the court will find harmless error.
Is the question whether the court could have or whether the court would have? I mean, I guess you would agree the district court relied to some extent on the social worker's testimony with respect to the children's fear?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And so if the district court mentioned that in its order, I mean, that indicates, it seems, that the district court found that evidence to be persuasive. Does the existence of other persuasive evidence toward the same end necessarily mean that the district court, in the absence of let's assume for the moment that the social worker's testimony was inadmissible or should not have been admitted. How do we know that in the absence of that testimony, the district court would have relied upon the other evidence in the record and reached the same findings?
Because I think the indication that the parties' reports of what happened, that means that at that particular time, the district court was focusing on the parties' testimony and not on the social worker's testimony, and it still found abusive behavior.
At that particular time, are you referring to a particular paragraph in the order?
I'm sorry. Page 5, yeah. Paragraph 18, Your Honor. And it says, the parties' reports of what happened do not differ greatly. That means that it found that appellant's testimony was very similar to what respondent recounted. And it said, respondent's version is a bit closer to what the children described. So it weighed, the trial court weighed the testimony of appellant, respondent, and the social workers in arriving at its conclusion.
And in the middle of the paragraph, the court wrote that his actions caused child J and petitioner to fall to the floor and to be in fear of bodily harm. How do we know that child J was in fear of bodily harm? I mean, what's the evidence that supports that particular statement by the district court?
That was respondent's testimony, Your Honor. At the hearing transcript, page 24, lines 11 through 21, where respondent mother testified, sometimes when he's teaching them and they're not grasping the concept, he would spank them, and sometimes he gets so violent. One instance when she, Janelle, that's the J, saw that he was going to hit her to dodge that hit, she turned her head and actually got hit on the other side of her mouth.
I guess my question is maybe not so much about the existence of evidence that might also provide support, might have provided independent support, but I guess my question is, how do we know what the district court would have done if the evidentiary record did not include any social worker testimony?
I don't think this court can predict, but I think this court can rely on what the district court actually said. And in weighing the testimony of the parties as well as the social workers, I think the district court's statement as to what it was looking at in its findings is indicative of the reasoning that the district court went through. And I appreciate the court struggling with the social worker's testimony. So my co-counsel will address that, but I just want to make sure that the court is aware that Mr. Keller talked about intent, that it's clear that appellant did not intend. There's no intent required in the domestic abuse statute. In terms of a finding, it said domestic abuse means if committed, not if intending to commit against a family or household matter. As far as the remaining question, was the social worker's testimony properly admitted as non-hearsay to establish the state of mind of the children? Again, the answer is an unequivocal yes, because appellant put the children's state of mind and their fear of him directly at issue. Even though the children told him that they were not afraid of him, when he was asked, "Is it your testimony that your children are not afraid of you?" appellant responded, "They are not."
Just regarding the hearsay, do you agree that the children, or at least that respondent, didn't make a sufficient showing that the children were actually unavailable? I mean, as that term is understood legally?
Correct, Your Honor. They did not. However, with 803, with the state of mind, availability is not an issue. It doesn't make any difference whether they were available or not.
But did your client have an obligation to raise that argument in front of the district court at the time that the hearsay objection was made for us to review the mental impression exception?
I think that counsel at that time were focused on the claim of privilege, which appellant was asserting at the lower court, and was...
I mean, they certainly also claimed a hearsay objection. I mean, in the record, they say objection, hearsay, and then... you know, your client made some arguments about why it was or was not hearsay that didn't include the mental impression exception. And so now we're stuck with a record where the district court didn't really rule on whether this would have fallen within the mental impression exception.
I agree, Your Honor, but I do feel that because the district court is typically hears social workers' testimony, they're the experts. They represent the children. The children are their clients. They are bound by the same standard that all of us are bound, the best interest of the children. So when they come in and testify as to what the children have told them, they are the ones who have that ability and authority and, in fact, obligation to report abuse and the facts that are associated with abuse.
But there was actually never a finding of maltreatment made here. And, in fact, there was not an open child protection case at the time that the hearing was happening. Isn't that right?
It is. If I recall correctly, that respondent testified that several, the social worker CPS had opened several files, but they closed them because of appellant's failure to participate in the process. So there was no finding of maltreatment, but there is the district court did find domestic abuse. And I think that the CPS worker's involvement in the case entitles the social workers to come in and testify as to what the children told them, their fear, and the abuse, which they do routinely. Because if that were not the case, Your Honors, then an abuser could come in and say, "I forbid, I do not want social workers to testify." That would shut down every case in which a social worker was involved. It is the responsibility and the obligation as mandatory reporters for them to testify as to abuse and come in and relate information that they have gleaned as a part of their responsibilities, report that to the court.
But we certainly do have case law that says the rules of evidence apply to OFP hearings. And so I understand what you're saying, but I think that what I understand appellant to be arguing is that that evidence needs to come in under the normal way that we allow some, there's some statements we just say aren't hearsay. There are some statements that we say are hearsay, but we're going to let them in anyway, and that the lawyers have an obligation to make that argument, and the district court needs to make those findings before that hearsay evidence comes in, which I don't think necessarily precludes social workers from testifying, but it does require the actual application of the rules of evidence in an OFP setting.
I think, Your Honor, then that would come in. The argument that was made at the district court was under 595.02 subdivision 1G. The last sentence makes sure that the testimony of social workers is about maltreatment and protection of vulnerable adults is not precluded by any assertion of waiver or any assertion of any privilege. And I think that is what was addressed at the district court rather than the hearsay issue. The last sentence says, "Nothing in this clause exempts licensed social workers from compliance with the provisions of Chapter 260E, which is reporting maltreatment of minors."
Ms. Richards, your time has expired. Perhaps you may sum up and then conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. In closing, Your Honors, the evidentiary record is clear. Appellant committed domestic abuse of the party's children. Based on a plethora of evidence, we ask the court to affirm the district court's October 25th, 2022 issuance of an OFP after hearing, which found that appellant's actions towards the party's children exceeded the reasonable bounds of parental discipline and caused the children to be in fear of imminent physical harm or bodily injury. We also ask this court to confirm the district court's decision that an abuser cannot prevent social workers from testifying in court proceedings on behalf of children who have suffered domestic abuse by asserting any privilege. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Mr. Keller, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. So, unfortunately, the respondent is arguing what they wish had happened and not what really happened. So we just heard a recitation of T-14, T-20, T-72, T-75, so many things I couldn't write it all down. And Judge Gaetis is correct, is that all that is essentially irrelevant because, as I pointed out previously, we're talking about Part 2 of the definition in the statute, which is fear, not Part 1, assault, because the trial court clearly was not issuing an OFP based on assault. Now, the respondent says that, well, we're misplaced in our argument that there has to be intentionality, but I think that's wrong. It has to be wrong because I wanted to grab the statute here again so that I can read the precise words. So the words say, like, assault, for example, that's part of it. Assault, to me, by definition, it's a common law definition and a statutory definition. It has to be intentional. So if I go by someone in the hallway and I accidentally bump into them, that's not an assault because it's not intentional.
Mr. Keller, is there any, I'm curious, is there any case law saying that in the context of an OFP or any case law interpreting the OFP statute saying that the assault must be an intentional or the injury or harm must be caused by an intentional act?
I don't have any to cite for you, Your Honor, so I cannot tell you whether it exists or not. I am ignorant on that point, but I think it's few and far between OFPs, and this is one of those that's few and far between, where the trial court found that there was some type of a touching or action done by the person that would be the respondent in the trial court, and that that was unintentional, and the trial court clearly found that in finding of fact 18, when the trial court says first that the petitioner asserts he did not intentionally push these people down, and then later on in the next sentence the trial court says respondent was at least heedless and reckless. Now the trial court here is a long-standing trial court judge. Trial court knew exactly what he was writing. He wrote down heedless and reckless. We know what those words mean. Those words mean something less than intentional. That's quite a specific choice of words and diction by the trial court. the respondent is here arguing that there these other incidents, and of course, as Judge Gaetis said in finding of fact 20, it's very clear that the trial court is not hanging its hat on those, and the trial court specifically says in finding 20 that they do not demonstrate domestic abuse. So we're really not talking about any of those things, even though the respondent wishes that we were. This case is exactly like Olson versus Olson that I mentioned before on our page 12 at 892 Northwest 2nd, 837, where Judge Cleary said hearsay is not admissible in a OFP, and Judge Cleary said it was prejudicial error because the findings were clearly predicated on the hearsay, and that's exactly the situation that we have here. Judge Johnson asked today about is it the trial court could have or they would have. Well, it's, I think, what the respondent said in the answer to that question, which is it's what the trial court actually said, and the trial court is clearly basically basing its findings on what the social workers said. The social workers really have no business testifying in any OFP in spite of what the respondent thinks, because this is not a matter of privilege. This, again, as we pointed out in our brief, the respondent's argument is conflating privilege and hearsay. Those are two different things, of course. The hearsay was clearly objected to here, as Judge Larson pointed out, at T43 and T57, so it's not that the hearsay was not objected to. The respondent did not raise this exception in the trial court, but I don't think the exception is correct anyways. There's an argument here that the social workers are experts and they're supposed to testify about the best interests. Of course, best interests have nothing to do with this, as we pointed out. There is no social worker exception to the hearsay rule. That's the bottom line. And therefore, the trial court was erroneous. It incorrectly admitted this testimony. It was clearly done to the prejudice of the appellant. And without that testimony, there is not sufficient evidence to uphold the order. Therefore, you must reverse the trial court. You must reverse the issuance of the order. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing in 90 days.